You made it. You've arrived. This is Peter Levitan's Advertising Stories. And you're about to hear entertaining, personal, often instructive stories from deep inside the world of advertising.
Hi, this is Peter Levitan. I'm going to make two predictions. Based on the work from home world that we're in, there will be more new babies born in 6 to 9 months. I will also predict that once the COVID situation moderates, we will see more advertising agencies bought and sold. So to the second point, I can't really handle the first one. I don't know if handle is the right word. I want to introduce you to Mark Holdreth, who is a partner, a guy that runs Media Advisory Partners. They provide mergers and acquisition services to small and mid-sized marketing services agencies, media companies, etc. Mark is going to help us understand how to create value for your agency, what buyers are looking for. They want more geography, more expertise, a bigger client roster. They just want to get bigger themselves. They want more cash flow. There is a process to get this done for both the seller and the buyer. And I'm going to hand this over to Mark. Today, I am talking to Mark Holdreth, who is in Long Island. Long Island?
Long Island. There you go.
Oh, you're on the north, right? So you're not in the Long Island part.
No. We're on the North Shore.
North Shore.
We're only like 12 miles from the city.
But isn't that where Gatsby lived, on the North Shore?
We actually do live very close to where Gatsby lived.
Well, yes. I'm glad you've made it in life. So
we live in the downriver area of where Gatsby is.
Well, you know,
we're not quite Gatsby-ish.
The help has to live somewhere.
There you go.
All right. Tell me about Media Advisory Partners.
Well, we're a small specialized M&A advisory firm. And we distinguish ourselves in a number of different ways. One thing we do is we focus on small to mid-sized companies. We don't do much in terms of Wall Street, unless we're acquiring maybe some assets that are being carved out from a larger public trade company. We focus on marketing services and media companies. We're really highly qualified as experienced operators. We run and own businesses. We've been investors and obviously have a lot of experience in M&A. So we work and believe very strongly in the team approach. We have a number of what we call advisory directors who are experts in various sectors of the verticals that we cover. We bring them in as needed, and we really distinguish ourselves by bringing a really high degree of personal care and attention. That's very important, especially to entrepreneurs and people that are, you know, selling their life's work. So we respect how important that is to them. And very importantly, we're the intermediary that protects the future relationship between the buyer and the seller. We kind of own the difficult decisions and have the difficult conversations that keep everybody in the process calm.
Calm is good.
Calm is very important.
Actually, closing the deal is good. Calm comes in second, I think, right?
Yeah, sometimes you don't close a deal if everybody doesn't stay calm.
Well, deals are crazy. I have a friend, I won't go into detail about him, but he had a big production company and was bought a couple of years ago by a huge digital consultancy. I mean, you can imagine these people. And once the deal was done, I just mentioned this because this stuff happens, the three gentlemen at the big consultancy left. And all of a sudden, my friend and his company, and he was paid well, as he likes to tell me, he bought a nice townhouse in Park Slope. He was like stuck all of a sudden. You know, like no one at the company had any memory of why they made the deal in the first place. I'm sure, you know. So certain things you can control, certain things you just can't. And that was his issue. I'm sure you've seen things like that happen in sort of post-deal territory.
Yeah, the process itself can be pretty stressful and can have surprises in it. And that's where an intermediary and somebody, an advisor, comes in to help keep things calm, but also to know what's kind of normal, what you should be concerned about and what you shouldn't be concerned about. You know, we've had deals that we're so close to closing that, you know, I tell my wife, go ahead and get the kids everything they want for the holidays and plan that trip to Spain. And the next day, the client wakes up and decides they don't want to go forward with the deal for whatever reason, and it can blow up. So until you really can't count your chickens.
So speaking of deals, what's going on in respect to activity, mergers and acquisition activity in what you call the marketing services industry?
Well, there are deals taking place. It's definitely not as active as it was, you know, before the pandemic, but there's activity out there for sure. There remains a tremendous amount of capital that needs to be deployed, especially in the hands of the financial buyers. And sometimes it's a strategic company, meaning an agency itself, that makes the acquisition, but it's really the private equity, if there's private equity behind them. So there are still a lot of buyers out there that are looking for the right kinds of assets. And essentially, though, if companies don't have to sell at this moment, they're inclined to wait. And the timing really depends on what a seller's motivation is.
Yeah, we're going to get into motivation. I wrote a book. I call it a book on how to sell an agency. And one of the things I talk about a lot there is my motivations for the purchase of a couple of agencies and sale. And I'm always interested in, and we'll get into this a little bit later. I'm always interested in watching sellers in particular not understand A, why they're selling, B, and this is a soft point but important, what are they going to do after they sell? We'll get there in a second. What noteworthy deals have you been involved in and seeing in the market at this point?
Well, two recent. One was a small agency, a specialty agency, that sold at an incredible, incredible multiple. In fact, the highest multiple I think I've ever seen. And it was sold at that multiple just at the beginning of the pandemic. It was highly sought after by the buyer because of the reputation of the agency, its brand, and its people, its management. And it also had an incredible roster of very longtime loyal clients. And another one is that we are currently in due diligence and hope to close within the next couple of weeks on a conference company, not a marketing services agency, but a conference company. And that's kind of interesting because, you know, we don't even know when the next conference is going to be held. And the pandemic is hurting the multiple a little bit, but we had multiple offers on this. And the ultimate buyer is paying a very, very good valuation because this company and its assets are really critical and important to the buyer, the acquiring company, being able to execute on a very, very innovative and aggressive growth strategy. So the point of all this is that there are deals getting done. This last deal I just mentioned, the conference business, the buyer and the seller have never met each other in person. In fact, the buyer's from the UK, United Kingdom. Everything's been done virtually. And if you have assets that you know, are attractive and add value to the acquiring company, we're seeing pretty good valuations.
So what was that multiple? You don't have to tell me the name of the agency that was purchased, but when you say high multiple, what is that number? And how do you calculate?
It was over 20.
Really?
So
20 times what? What was the base?
EBITDA. Okay.
Interesting.
So, okay. Yeah. EBITDA. So.
Yeah, I know. Many advertising agency leaders are not necessarily financial geniuses.
Well, and EBITDA simply means earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization.
Right. Well, purchases are interesting. I've mentioned this story to you earlier. I was working at Saatchi & Saatchi Advertising Worldwide, both in New York and London during the days when they were, to put it mildly, acquisition-oriented. The goal was to be the largest agency in the world, which they became. And also, because I ran business development, I had these charts, and I called them dots on the map. We wanted lots of dots on the map, so we could go to a Procter & Gamble and say, we can handle your business in any country in the world. That was the plan. So while that was happening, I was also running Northwest Airlines, and Northwest said, do you guys happen to have an office in Korea, in Seoul? We'd like to take the business from McCann and hand it to you, but you have to have an office. I didn't know if we had an office. You know, there was no, at that point, no internet. I couldn't just go on the website. So I called up the guy, you know, the CFO, and I said, what's up? And he goes, yeah, we just bought an agency in Seoul. So I said, great. So I flew to Seoul a couple of days ahead. I told Northwest, we have an office. Northwest said, okay, we'll meet you in Seoul. I flew a couple of days ahead. I get to the office of the agency we bought, which, by the way, no one at Saatchi had ever seen. It was a dot, right? That was our criteria. Was it a dot? It's a dot. Okay, downtown, cool. And I get to the office, I realize there are like 6 to 8 people at work in the agency. And I'm trying to bring in what's for us is a $70 million account globally. And I got this, oh my God, what am I going to do? So make a long story short, when the client showed, I had coached the people in the agency. It was a 2-floor agency. When the client came in, they saw 8 people. And then as the client was going up in this little mini elevator that they had, I rushed the 8 people to the 2nd floor. So it looked like we had 16 people.
Wow.
So that was the Northwest Airlines due diligence on the deal that Saatchi had not performed any due diligence on other than wanting to get a dot. So I only tell the story just to kind of indicate that there have been, at least in the olden days, some crazy purchases by the big boys. I think those days are over.
Yeah, due diligence is important. And yeah, certainly the holding companies are nowhere near as aggressive in terms of acquisitions that they had been. But the due diligence, the first company that we ever represented in a sale, is actually how I got in this business, was a gentleman I knew was selling his ad agency, a digital agency, and called me and wanted to know if I could introduce him to any bankers. And I did. And then after meeting a number of them, he came back and said, you know, I had another board meeting. The board wants you to sell the business. And I said, well, I'm not an advisor or banker. I've never sold the business before. So I teamed up with one of the other founding partners. Ultimately, we ended up finding media advisory partners. But before we did that, we teamed up and he was very experienced and he helped me. And we sold this company, digital agency, to a company in India that had a U.S. subsidiary. And things didn't go too well. And a year later, we ended up helping our client buy his company back from the Indian company because the Indian company didn't have the funds that were required for them to be able to live up to the earnout portions of the deal. So, you know, a good lesson about due diligence. When you're on the sell side, you want to make sure that you have a credible buyer.
Like see the car they drive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and again, when a holding company's buying you, you don't have to be too concerned if there's, you know, if there's a financial buyer, you know, obviously they've got funds. And so, you know, you have to be pretty careful though, when you start getting into individuals.
Well, I'd imagine if we're doing deals today and you mentioned the deal earlier where people are not meeting. And every deal I've done, I have to say, even down to internet companies that I got funded, I would hang out with the VCs or I would go over to somebody's office. I would get that kind of soft sense that they were cool. Now, of course, you know, trying to assume that anyone has money is a fool's assumption at this point. But
right.
Speaking of money, here is a mini commercial. Did you know that it takes months to sell or buy a business, even digital and ad agencies? Selling is a complicated process. A process that must start way ahead of the decision to sell if you want the best price. Peter Levitan's free, yes I said free, 57-page book on how to maximize the value of your agency can be downloaded at peterlevitan.com. You'll learn how to grow your agency's value, how to build a handsome marketing plan and how to play the valuation game to get the right price. Just head over to peterlevitan.com for your free copy. Start growing your advertising or digital agency's value today.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, that leads into a good question. What advice would you give a marketing services company that is considering a sale? So they're sitting there and going, you know, either, you know, as we know, just let me get the hell out of here, or I think I've built up something of value and this is the right time to do it. What's your advice?
Well, interesting. You know, going back, you mentioned your book, which I did read, by the way, and I found it to be very good. So if you're out there thinking about selling your company's marketing services firm, read Peter's book. I think the biggest thing is to understand the motivation to sell and the objectives with a sale, you know, and then and think those through and be able to articulate them well. And one of the first questions you get from any potential buyers, you know, why do you want to sell? They want to understand what your motivation is. And they want to understand what your role is to be post-transaction. So that's really important as a seller.
So what advice do you give an agency to make the decision to sell?
Well, again, I think an advisor can help you with that. We often talk to people about and when they should sell and if we're the right for each other. So, you know, that's a conversation that an advisor should be willing to have with a potential seller to help them get to the right point and decide not only if they're going to sell, but if they can work together and if it's the right time.
And, I obviously we're in this lunatic world for a while. Are people thinking, I'm going to separate buyers and sellers for a second. Are sellers saying, wait, I think you said that.
Yeah. I mean, if they don't have to sell, I think a lot of buyers are saying, I don't have to sell. I'm not going to sell. And you were going to separate buyers from sellers?
Yeah. And okay. So are buyers saying, damn, this is a good time to, you know, go get some good assets?
Yes. And, I think people will say, is this kind of a buyer's market? And I guess you could say yes, but at the same time, I'd say no. I mean, multiples are down a bit. And there's certainly what we call bottom feeders out there on the buy side that are looking for distressed businesses. And they're kind of like, you know, we're waiting for the blood in the water, to use a terrible phrase. But again, as going back to those two examples that I cited, if you have value and you bring value to a buyer, value that enables them to either enhance or execute a growth strategy, that value will be recognized in the valuation, even in this environment.
Okay. Here's a question that's a little bit above my pay grade. Are people selling majority stakes? Are they taking equity? Do they want to leave? Or is it all over the map?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very personal issue, right? I mean, and in some companies, you can have a mix. If there's a, let's say the company is owned by three partners or four partners or two partners or whatever, you may have one of those partners that wants to stay because they want to roll over equity because they're excited about what the buyer is bringing to the table and what that buyer and being a part of that buyer's company will enable them to do. So, you know, the thinking there is with additional resources and investment from the right buyer, we can accelerate our growth strategy and we can grow this business even faster. So I want to be a part of that and I'm going to hold on to some of my equity. I'll roll it over. And other people are just like, I want to get out. I've had it, you know, it's time to retire and move into another phase of my life. So it's, again, that all goes back to understanding what you really want, because that will possibly impact the process that you undergo in the sale. And it certainly would impact your evaluation of potential buyers and who you might even go out to and approach with the sale process.
One thing we've discussed is, in respect to the motivation, is understanding the end game for the seller. Are people not, I mean, this is something that, you know, kind of semi blows my mind. Are people not really fully aware of what they want to do after they sell, or are they so involved in the sales process that they haven't thought through their personal end game?
I think that it's there are definitely people out there that know what they want to do, but what's, again, this whole process is at times, kind of an emotional one, right? You know, you've built something, you want to see it succeed in its future. You're concerned about its legacy, your employees, and you start a process and you say, I really want to move on to do this, and I want to be out in 6 months to a year. And sometimes that works that way. And other times it's like, whoa, this is kind of interesting. I really, you know, I like these buyers. I like what they're doing. And, you know what? Maybe I'll stick around for 3 years. So it can be a combination of, you know, I start the process with this intent and these objectives and these motivations. And then those evolve as I go through this process. And sometimes they don't, but sometimes they do evolve and change.
What percentage of deals are include a earnout or some general contingency plan?
In these smaller mid-sized companies, the majority of them definitely have contingency payments in them. And there's reasons for that. Oftentimes the ownership, this is not always the case. And in fact, I think in recalling some of what I read in your book, it wasn't necessarily so in your case, but oftentimes the business is dependent on that management team or that ownership team. And the buyer wants to make sure that there's a good transition. And when you're in the marketing services business and you have close relationships with clients, you know, the clients want to make sure that you're happy with the deal, and the buyer wants to make sure that you're happy with the deal, and the buyer wants to make sure that you keep those clients happy and transition them over well. So it's a way to mitigate risk. There's always risk in a transaction for a buyer especially, and one of the best ways for them to mitigate that risk is by having some sort of contingency payment.
Right. Well, the last deal I did have a buyout or contingency payment, and I exited the business. My plan was not to stick around, and I only stuck around kind of twiddling my thumbs and eating lunch out for 3 months just to make sure everything was smooth. One of the elements, I'll call it part of a contingency plan for me, was to ensure that my employees rolled over to the new company. So how should they think about their employees? These are not shareholders.
Right. Well, again, it varies greatly from, you know, transaction to transaction. I think the buyers, it's going to depend on the buyer too. So if I'm making the acquisition as a buyer because I'm really interested in the capabilities and the expertise of this particular agency, and then the people become a very, very important part of that. So I'm going to want those people to come along with the transaction. And typically, not typically, generally always in a transaction, the buyer is going to want to understand who the key employees are. And they're going to want to understand what makes those employees key and how important those employees are to go with the transaction. On lower level, you know, buyers oftentimes looking for synergies. They're looking for areas where they can cut costs. So if there are redundancies you know, in financial people or, you know, in the administration area, you know, oftentimes those people do not go forward with the transaction, right. But it depends on the deal.
Okay.
And the good news, bad news, I should say, about that kind of a situation when you sell and they don't take all of your employees, what a buyer does is they put together what's called a pro forma P&L. So you provide your P&L for the business and they look at it and they look at your organizational structure. And then they say, we can take this much cost out, including some people. And that increases on their pro forma P&L, which you'll never see, that increases the profitability of the company. And so the multiple they're willing to spend goes against the higher P&L. So it allows them to pay and sharpen their pencil and get a little better price for you.
Right. Well, the thing, what my great offer in the sale, at least the last deal I did, was that I exited. So as the highest paid person in the company, I split, which was really part of my strategy, was to be able to say, excuse me, to the seller, to the buyer, that you could take my salary out of the deal and they would do their own P&L. Excuse me. The way I got there was by, over the last year, really exiting the client contact. I went to annual meetings or quarterly meetings, but I wasn't a day-to-day person on any piece of business. My ego didn't need that. And I knew actually that it would allow me to leave and do what one of my goals was to get every employee that I had moved over, because they were I also made them critical to each account. Right. So anyway, that was good news. I always pat myself on the back. I mean, to be able for me to leave and say everybody had a job was great. Plus, it made the mentioning, oh, by the way, we're selling the agency, a hell of a lot easier for everybody.
It does,
right?
But that's a great situation if you can do that. And but the buyer's got to be very confident that you in fact do not have to be replaced. And so, you know, if they're confident and comfortable with that, then, you know, it's to your benefit in terms of the valuation because the costs are lower.
Okay. Well, I want to sort of round a little bit to an end conversation, which is your skill set and how your company counsels people. How do agencies and how do you help agencies prepare for the sale? How do they, one, grow the value of their agency possibly before they've even put the agency on the market? I assume that that happens often. And how do you work through the process with them?
Well, we sit down with the seller, and as I mentioned earlier, we determine, you know, issues related to timing, et cetera, and take a look at the business overall, and then discuss issues like we've just been talking about. You know, who owns those relationships with the client? What is your role as the owner? What do you want to do, et cetera, et cetera? But you know, usually companies are bought for, you know, one of four reasons. An agency wants to expand in a geographic area. They want to add capabilities, expertise, some specialty. They are, you know, desiring of your client roster, or they simply just want to scale the business, right? They want to get bigger. So valuations are based on evaluating those four things and how they can complement or help develop a buyer's growth strategy. And then your historical financial performance, client concentration, and what we would identify as risk areas for the buyer are important to address. And then interestingly enough, culture and chemistry are really critical. So you can't prepare ahead of time for culture and chemistry. You're either going to have it or you're not. But all of those other areas in terms of getting your financials in shape, having a growth strategy, being able to articulate a growth strategy, understanding how to, as you did, deal with your clients and prepare before you go to market is important.
Yep. Well, one thing I mentioned, again, I hate to say this, it sounds like these people that are on a PR tour for their book. One of the things I mentioned in my book is shining up the agency, you know, buffing it up a little bit, making sure that website looks good. Even though financials come down to the numbers, there are ways to present them that look better, that look like you're smarter. You know, just sending out a quickie done spreadsheet may not inspire financial confidence. I find all of these things, you know, they're subtle, but they add to the impression of brilliance and kind of demonstrate that culturally and business development wise, you're smart. There's another thing that I've mentioned to agencies. I mentioned to agencies that don't even want to sell themselves is having some intellectual property, some IP. Do you counsel agencies to kind of get that together? Because I could see it happening in the space you were talking about earlier, the sale that you're working on, which is the conference business. You know, how it looks and feels when I try to sign up for a conference makes me feel more confident that the conference is smart, and it would make me feel more confident that the company is smart.
Sure, yeah. UX is important, right? You know, what we do is we put together something that's called a CIM, which CIM, which stands for a confidential information memorandum. And it is only provided to buyers that have signed non-disclosure agreements. And it's, you know, provided at a certain point in the process. So as we put together the CIM, which tells pretty much the story of the business, the agency, it includes financials, it includes organizational structure, it includes, you know, all kinds of information. You know, that is done very professionally. And especially when you're dealing with agencies, there's a sensitivity to just how well done it is and how it's designed. So yes, it's really important to present the agency, not only the figures, but as you say, how you present it, right?
Yep.
So we put a lot of time and effort in the design of these sims.
All right, two last questions. One, how early should an agency be thinking about selling, or the process of selling, the taking a hard look at your own agency, seeing what you can improve, reducing costs, if that makes sense, if it doesn't hurt the business, and all of the above? When should somebody say, okay, I'm going to start thinking about this today?
Well, I mean, the sooner the better, right? I mean, if you can, buyers look historically, and we represent buyers as well as sellers, by the way, and when we're doing buy-side representation, you know, and when we're even putting together a sim on the sell side, we look at a 3-year history and then a forecast. Hope sometimes a 2 or 3 year forecast, if you can believe it. Most small agencies can't do that. So you're looking at least forecasts for the rest of 2020, for example, if someone was selling now, and maybe 2021, but we'd look back 3 years. So the performance of the business over that 3-year period, the better it is, the better the valuation. So if you can start making changes and improvements to your business today and think about a 3-year horizon, that's fabulous. Unfortunately, most people don't do that and can't do that.
Yeah.
Because a 3-year period's a hard, you know, who knows what's going to happen in 3 years, right? But if you have that luxury, that would be fabulous, because it's that 3-year history that people are going to look at. In reality, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think one way to handle it, although it's all somewhat guesswork, is maybe 3 scenarios, right? So best case, middle case, I wouldn't call it worst case, but, you know, maybe where we are today, where we could be, and where we really could be, might at least inspire some confidence. I'll mention, before I get to the last question, just a quickie thing. There's a tool on the internet. It's amazing to me how few people know about this, called the Wayback Machine. And the Wayback Machine, I think it's run, actually it doesn't matter who runs it, but if you go to it, you can see the home pages of any company over time. So you can go back to, you know, I don't know, 2015, what did this company look like? There's some benefit in that. It's kind of funny sometimes, because you go back and you see how bad home pages looked 10 years ago. Yeah. But it is a way for somebody to scope out, what was this company thinking? What was their sale? What was their proposition, their positioning in the past? So I just throw that out. I'll put that. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. But, you know, you're sparking something as you're talking. I was thinking about, you know, again, it's that history people look at. One of the things, and you mentioned business development, most agencies don't have any kind of formal business development program. Everything's pretty much word of mouth. They also many times do not have a forecasting capability or methodology. So when you get into the selling process, if you can put together, start thinking ahead about, you know, what can we do in terms of a more professional or more formalized business development program, forecasting capabilities, because that gives some comfort, again, to a buyer, right? If you take those parts of your business seriously, and you can document and kind of show that to a buyer, that gives them more comfort. Again, more comfort, less risk, better valuations.
Right. Well, it is mind-blowing how few agencies actually can put the business development plan, in front of a client. Speaking of business development, so my last question is, how do we find media advisory partners?
I was chuckling to myself here, because I was thinking we really do a terrible job at business development. But well, the best way to find media advisory partners is go online and Google us at Media Advisory Partners. And the website's mediaadvisorypartners.com.
Well, that's pretty simple. Well, you know, you can always hire me to help you with your business development plan, although I'd like to think that this podcast is is going to help you. So, all right, thank you very much. I will say that I will never again buy or sell an advertising agency. I don't know which god of the universe to thank for that, but that ain't going to happen. But if I did, my last thought is I would hire an expert like y'all.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm happy to hear that you're pleased about not having to be involved in buying and selling an agency.
Okay.
So I enjoyed this very much. Thank you very much, Peter.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Take it easy.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Here are a couple of housekeeping things now that you know how to sell or buy an advertising agency and, frankly, a digital agency or like any other business. I mean, let's kind of go for it. Deep breath. Here's the deal. Tell your friends about Advertising Stories. Subscribe to Advertising Stories. Let me hypnotize you. Subscribe to Advertising Stories. I want to thank Warren Buffett's team for helping me record today. And note that in a short period of time, you will hear an interview with Michael Farmer, who helps all of the major advertising network companies make more money. And he wrote a book with a very interesting title, Madison Avenue Manslaughter. And just to prove that Michael has his shit together, the foreword was written by Sir Martin Sorrell. See you later, guys.